Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, on the Heritage Radio Network. This is the show is live, so if you have anything you'd like to question us or bring up, you can call in. The number is 718-497-2128. And if you need any further information about the network, what it is, and all that stuff, you can get on your computer and go to info@heritageradionetwork.com. And our sponsor this morning, it's still morning, let's see, yes, it's still morning, we have another minute, is TechServe, which is a terrific outfit. And what we're going to do is, this is part two of our show on Darwin and evolution, and my guest is Saul Scheinbach, and he is a biologist, his training as a microbiologist, and he is my guest this morning, and he's a friend of mine, and we were talking about genes and species and all that stuff, and I'm going to ask Saul a question to get everything started. So what do genes tell us about evolution, Saul? We spoke about genes in the other show. The genes are the carriers of the information to form proteins that make our structure, basically, right?
Correct.
Okay, so what does it tell us about evolution? And then we'll go back to talking about Darwin in a minute.
Well, as you said in the first program, Darwin didn't know anything about genes, but nevertheless, genes play an important role in evolution. They're important because they play a role in the development of an embryo from a fertilized egg. If you think about it, you have a fertilized egg and the egg multiplies into many different cells. But all those cells have the same genetic information because the DNA has been making copies of itself. So the genes in all these cells are the same. So the question biologists have been asking for the past 100 years is, well, if all the genes are the same, if all this information is the same, how do we get all of these different types of cells? How do we get muscle cells and blood cells and skin cells and bone cells? Well, it goes back to what I said in the first part, that these genes are controlled. They turn on and they turn off in the embryo at different times. So, for example, if we look at a red blood cell, all it's doing is making hemoglobin, the protein hemoglobin. That's the only gene that's turned on in that cell. All the other genes are shut down.
That's when the cell is a designated cell to make the hemoglobin, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So something has to turn it on and get it going, right?
That's
and
correct.
So we're going into the new branch of biology called Evo-Devo.
Yes.
And Saul will go into that a little bit more. So remember, this is following up all the work that Darwin did in his day, but he didn't know about these mechanisms. But in his writings, he knew that there was something doing this, but he had no idea what it was. And the latest research now that many biologists are doing in is called Evo-Devo, which talks about the development of the what goes on in the embryo.
That's right. It's a new science, relatively new. It's only 20 years old. And it uses the approaches of evolutionary biologists who study how organisms form new species and developmental biologists who look at the way genes control development of an organism. And what they found was astounding. In the 80s, they were looking at the genes that control development in the fruit fly. That's that little fly that bugs the heck out of you in the warm weather. It's always flying around your bananas. And what they found was that the development of the fruit fly embryo is controlled by just 8 genes. These 8 genes are what could be called master control genes. They are the ones that boss the other genes around. How do they do it? Well, they make proteins. they make what are called signal proteins. And these signal proteins tell the other genes what to do. So these master genes determine how the body is organized. They determine how you get a head and a tail, where that's going to form, left and right, top and bottom. And what amazed people at that time was that when they looked at these control genes in the fruit fly and they began looking for them in other organisms, they found basically the same genes. So, for example, there's a gene that controls eye development that they found in the fruit fly. That same gene makes the eye in the squid, in fish, in frogs, in lizards, in birds, and even us. It's the same gene. So how does that go back to Darwin? Well, what it's saying is that natural selection doesn't work from scratch. Evolution doesn't work from scratch. You don't have to keep making new genes. You simply take the old genes and use them in different ways. And that's how evolution can occur. And it's not so complicated. We used to think it was very complicated. But in the end, what we are learning is that the same genes produce different ends through differential control. That we can get an arm and a leg from the fins of a fish. We can go all the way back to the fins of a fish and see that the fins of a fish produced the limbs of all the four-legged creatures that we know today. And that's pretty amazing. It's the same genes that are doing that. And what does it tell us again about evolution? It tells us that we are all related. And Darwin knew that. We said he drew the tree of life in his book. That was the first tree of life that anyone ever published. So he did that. By the way, he published that book after he had been on this voyage, the voyage of the Beagle. And maybe you want to say something about that, Bernie.
Okay. So we're going to talk about Darwin's voyage. He got this chance to go on the ship, the Beagle, which was sponsored by the British Navy probably sponsored. They gave them money.
They were doing a survey of the South American coast.
Right. They were mapping the coast for the British Navy because Britain was a big naval power, and it was a big advantage if you had charts of the coastline and the waters. You know, you had a big advantage over maybe your enemy who didn't know about that. So he was asked to go along on the trip, basically to keep the captain company. The captain was, a well-educated man, and he wanted somebody on the boat that he could have conversations with and that they could have discussions with. So Darwin jumped at the chance, even though I think he was just newly married at the time. Was he married yet? Oh, he was going to be married after the voyage. Yes. And the voyage took 5 years, so he had a patient woman waiting for him. So he went along as the naturalist on the ship. And he was a very tall guy, as I remember. And he had trouble fitting into the berth in the cabin. I remember that little detail. And they had to cut out a couple of drawers from, there was a bureau next to the bed, so he could stretch his legs out and fit into it. So that's why Darwin went to the Galapagos Islands. He didn't just go to the Galapagos. He went with the Beagle, which started from England and sailed down the coast, North America, South America, around into the Pacific, and then up towards the Galapagos. But I'm going to let Saul take over now, and he's going to tell us what happened on the Galapagos that influenced Darwin's writings and thoughts.
So Darwin comes to this group of islands, this archipelago, which is about 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador. And geologically speaking, these are new pieces of land. They're only a couple of million years old. They're volcanic. And he goes around on several of these islands, and what he sees is that organisms on different islands are slightly different from each other, that the tortoises have different shaped shells depending on which island they come from. He looks at this group of birds called the mockingbirds, and he sees that they're also different. And he looks at these birds that have now become famous, that we now call Darwin's finches, and they are so different in their beaks that he thinks they are all a huge different different species of birds. He collects them, but he doesn't know for sure what they are. until he brings them back to England. And what he also observes is that although these organisms on the islands are different from each other, they do resemble the ones on the mainland. And that gets him thinking. So he comes back to England and he shows these finches to an ornithologist. And the ornithologist says, you know what? These birds are all very closely related. They're not as diverse as you think. They're not all these way different finches and other kinds of birds. They're really close to each other. And that really gets him thinking. And 4 years later, he writes a book about the voyage of the Beagle. And in that book, I have a quote I'd like to read. He says, in the 13 species of ground finches, a nearly perfect gradation may be traced from a beak extraordinarily thick to one so fine that it may be compared with that of a warbler. Seeing this gradation and diversity of structure in one small, intimately related group of birds, one might really fancy that one species had been taken and modified for different ends. So there it is. There's the first time he's brave enough to write that species can change and they can become new species.
Right, because people in that era thought that when God created the world, he made everything perfect. So species would never change. They were immutable, right? And that they would never change. But here's where Darwin, I guess, you know, got this idea in his head that maybe the species do change. And I think, as Saul said, that set him off on that track, realizing the beginning of evolution, the way critters evolved.
That's right. And at that time, people did see fossils. Darwin, in fact, dug up some fossils on his own. In South America, he found a huge sloth and a huge armadillo. And people would say, well, okay, that's great. We know that these individuals lived in some earlier time, they thought a few thousand years ago. But we know that Noah's flood occurred. The Bible tells us that Noah's flood occurred. So all of these things that died, well, they existed before and they were wiped out by the flood.
Hmm. Yeah, so what Saul has done is he has some terrific photographs of these finches that he's taken. And after you finish listening to the show, you can go to the photo gallery of Heritage Radio Network, and you can see the pictures of these finches, and you can see the beaks. So what we're going to do when we come back to the second part of the show is we're going to talk about why the beaks are different.
Yes.
What drove this? Why did it happen? It happened on one island. It was really, the island was isolated from the other islands, and how did you get this speciation, which is what changes in these finches? And did they become separate species, Saul, or are they just still the same species, but their physical characteristics have changed because of the food?
No, what has happened is one species got blown, a group of birds got blown to the islands a couple of million years ago, and they branched out. They branched out and formed 13 species of birds on these islands. And we'll talk about it in a little more detail in the next segment.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to sign off for a minute. And by the way, if you listen to this great music that we're playing now that's all picked out, it's Stravinsky's Rites of Spring. And it depicts a lot of primitive dancing. So and the springtime was a time of recreation and the renewal. So it was an important thing. Yeah. Thank you. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the Heritage Radio Network. The show is called The Naturalist, and today we're talking about Darwin and his theory of evolution, because last year was the 200th anniversary of his birth and the 150th anniversary of Darwin publishing his Origin of the Species. So my guest today is Saul Scheinbach, and we were talking about the Galapagos when the Darwin went on his voyage, and he started looking at these finches. And when Saul said that he brought them back to England, well, he didn't bring them back alive. What they did in the old days, that when they collected them, is they would kill the bird and just take the skin back to study it, right? So also, why don't you talk some more about what happened, what drove these finches to develop different beaks?
Well, Darwin didn't understand the mechanism, as we said, but what he figured out was that these finches were able to come from the mainland. Remember, he saw that they resembled organisms on the mainland. So he figured somehow they got blown onto these islands, and they could now move around on the islands without any competition, and they could go through a variety of adaptations, of changes. Again, he didn't know how that could happen, but he could say that these finches were adapting to these different islands. And as I said, I read in the quote before, he's talking about their beaks, which are so different. And you can see those photos on the website. They're not my photos, but I took them from researchers. I'll talk about these researchers in a moment. And you can see a whole variety of beaks in these 13 different species. And so Darwin said, well, this is an example of one species forming many. We have a name for that today. We call it adaptive radiation, where one form branches out into many different places and forms many new species. It radiates out. And islands are great places for new species to form. So it was fortuitous that Darwin stopped on this group of islands where he could see this. And people are still studying these finches today in the Galapagos. This husband and wife team, Peter and Rosemary Grant from Princeton University, have become famous doing this. They have spent the last 35 years, each year they spend about 3 or 4 months on one of the islands in particular called Daphne Major. It's a tiny cinder cone. It's in other words, the peak of an extinct volcano. It's barely 1 square mile. And what they do in the months they live there, they live like Mr. and Mrs. Robinson Crusoe. I was fortunate enough to be there a few years ago on a trip, and I managed to get a photograph of them sitting under their tent. What they do there is they capture every bird that lives on the island, every one of the finches, and they measure their beaks. They measure their body weight. They take a blood sample to look at their DNA, all sorts of body measurements. And they have found something very exciting. What they see is that these birds are changing quite rapidly. Darwin thought that these changes might not occur so quickly. But on this particular island in particular, they've been looking at three species of what are called ground finches, large, medium and small ground finches. And they've also been looking at the rainfall. And what they see is that over these 35 years, the rainfall can vary quite a bit. The islands are nowadays, they're very dry. They used to be much wetter, more like Hawaii. But the climate has dried up. And most years, they barely get 5 inches of rain. But in an El Nino year, they can get 50 inches of rain. 50 inches is what we get here in New York City, so you can get an idea. And in a good year like that, lots of plants grow and they make seeds. And that's what these finches, these ground finches, are eating. They're eating seeds. But some plants make large, big seed pods that are very tough to crack open, like a walnut. But if you can crack it open, you can get the nutritious nut. Other plants make smaller, softer seeds. And so the birds have evolved. They've changed into birds that have these different beaks. Remember, the beak is their tool. It's like a wrench. So these ground finches have different size, heavy duty, but different size beaks to eat these different seeds. And what the grants have seen is that because the rainfall fluctuates so greatly, the size of the beaks change too. So in particular, the medium ground finch, in the 30 years they've looked at it, its beak got quite larger over a period of time because it needed to be able to break down the larger seeds in order to survive. It needed to be able to attack those seed pods.
What's driving it is a changing food supply.
Exactly. Right?
And so there must be some kind of a mechanism that's causing this change. I mean, the finches just didn't say we're going to grow bigger beaks. So what was driving this? How did this work?
Well, these birds, it turns out, these birds are highly adaptable, very variable. And part of the work that the grants have done is they've looked at what we would call the molecular mechanism by which this happens. And you can actually see in the developing embryo, you can look for these molecules that are made by the controlling genes that turn on and off the genes that make structure. So there are genes that make the beaks, and they get turned on and off at different times in the embryo.
Mm-hmm. So this is an example of survival of the fittest, I would say.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, because they are adapting to changing conditions.
Yeah, the rainfall is erratic, and if you measure the size of the beaks of these finches, you see that they change in an erratic sort of way also, but it mimics the change in the rainfall and the food supply, the size of the seeds that are the food supply. There's another finch that lives on this island called the cactus finch, and that bird's beak is more like the needlenose pliers because it probes the cactus flowers and eats the pollen and the nectar. And the grants just recently published a paper, just a few weeks ago, in which they say they have found a new species. In 1982, they observed a bird that landed on Daphne on this island, and they measured it, and it was kind of an intermediate in size and in beak between the cactus finch that has a long, thin beak and the heavy-duty beak of the ground finch. And they followed it over the last 27 years, and they've been able to see that this bird has produced a number of different generations. It's produced six different generations now, and for the last three generations, all of the descendants of this bird are breeding between themselves, among themselves. They're not breeding with any of the other birds. So they look different. They have a beak that's intermediate in size between the ground finch and the cactus finch. And they have a different song from the cactus finch and the ground finch. And so by all measure, they are a new species.
Okay, so we should stress the fact that originally people thought that evolution takes a long time, adaptation. But we see that in this case, it was only like 20 years of their observation, and there you may have a new species that has evolved. So we have to stress that it happened over the generations of these birds. It just didn't happen in one generation that the beak got bigger, but the birds were able to adapt, and the birds that had the biggest beak, were better able to survive under those conditions because the climate had changed a little bit and the rainfall had changed, and they had to adapt to what food was available.
Now, these birds may die out too. We don't know. We're going to follow them. But of course, remember that 99.9% of all the species that ever existed on the planet are extinct.
Yeah, so the secret to evolution or successful survival is adapt or die.
Change,
adapt, or you may not make it because you don't know. Your conditions may change.
Exactly.
So that goes for people also. If you can't adapt to new situations, you're in big trouble. And a lot of people have found that out in this economy, which is an example of a changing environment. It's a tough situation, but you have to adapt to it. If you can't adapt, then you're in big trouble. So that's one of the driving theories of evolution. And not only with the finches, it happens in other places too. And if we have time in the next segment, I'll tell us a story that I know about on another island in Lake Superior, where there was a relationship between wolves and moose and spruce trees. So maybe we'll have time to talk about that also. But we're going to talk some more about the way evolution works when we come back after this break. But I want to remind you that this is live today. So if you want to call in, I'll give you that phone number quickly. And it's 718-497-2128. Okay, here we are back on the air. This is Bernie Wards, the Naturalist, and we're on the Heritage Radio Network coming from beautiful downtown Bushwick on a cold, sunny day. And my guest today is Saul Scheinbach, and he is talking about evolution and Darwin, and we've gotten into it quite a bit. So we're going to continue with our discussion now. And Saul, you told me earlier that you... we want to talk about structures that are lost through evolution and how that happens. What happens when a structure is no longer needed? Like the example of the blind cavefish.
Yeah. Excuse me. It's an interesting topic because I think people are often confused about it. I call it Darwin in the dark because it's about blind animals living in caves. So if you go into caves, you can find all sorts of animals there, shrimp and fish and amphibians, and they're all blind. And the question is, why would they lose their eyes? Well, what we know about what we've been talking about is that, well, to do that, you have to get a change in the DNA. You have to have a mutation that's going to eliminate the eyes. And if that change benefits the organism and it's inherited, then Darwin said, well, it's going to get passed on through natural selection. But here's what you have to remember. Sight in the dark is neither harmful nor beneficial. It doesn't matter whether you're blind or not. If you don't have any eyes, you're just as sighted as I am with my eyes in the dark. So why would natural selection occur? Well, this is a question that bedeviled Darwin himself. In his book, The Origin of Species, and I'll read you the quote, here's what he says. First time he brings it up, he says, by the time an animal had reached, after numberless generations, the deepest recesses, disuse on this view will have more or less perfectly obliterated its eyes. So what he says is, well, if you don't use it, you lose it. But then, just a few pages later, he says, I think we may conclude that the effects of use and disuse have often been largely combined with and sometimes overmastered by natural selection of innate differences. So which is it, Darwin? What do you really have to say, Charlie? Well, he was confused. He was unsure. But finally, he does stick with natural selection. And so, does eye loss occur because they're no longer needed in the dark? Bernie, let me ask you, when was the last time you used your nipples for anything?
Oh, not for a long time, Saul. I was tempted to put some of those rings on them like the kids do, but I resisted that.
Okay, the reason I ask, of course, is you don't use them for anything.
Right. Why do men have nipples?
That's right.
A good question.
So just because you don't use them doesn't mean that you're going to lose them. In evolution, use it or lose it doesn't apply. We could take babies that are born, all the human babies that are born, tie off one leg and make them hop around on one leg. That doesn't mean that they would end up losing one leg. A mutation has to occur to cause a change, and if that change is beneficial, it will be selected for. So let's go back to these fish. These fish that are losing their eyes. I am a collector of tropical fish. I have some of these fish in my fish tank. They're called blind Mexican cavefish, and they're perfectly fine. They swim around. They don't bump into things because they can echolocate through the lateral line. They can feel pressure waves in the water, so they know if there's an object nearby. They find food quite readily. They don't starve to death, even though all the other fish have eyes. And so, well, what's going on here? What's happening? Well, what people have learned is that there is a fish, it's a group of called tetras, and there is a closely related tetra that lives in the surface pools, and it has eyes. And it's pretty clear that when these tetras invaded the caves, they lost their eyes. And what's remarkable is that all the organisms that go into the caves, they eventually lose their eyes. And what people have learned through the science of Evo Devo that we talked about a few minutes ago is that they have all these organisms have a mutation in one of these master control genes, one of these genes that controls the way the embryo develops. And that gene sends out a signal to the other genes that control the structures in the head. Well, what's in the head? Ah, the eyes are in the head. So when this gene mutates, it causes the fish to become blind. But you know what? It does something else. It also causes the fish to have a bigger jaw with more teeth. It also causes the fish to have a better nose for smelling. It also causes the fish to have taste buds on its chin. Well, if you think about it, those other changes are good in the dark. That fish is going to survive better than somebody else in the dark if he has taste buds on his chin, and if he has a bigger jaw to catch things that are moving by, he's going to survive better. Mm-hmm. So eye loss is merely a byproduct of those other changes.
Okay, so would you call them random changes, Saul? Or are they driven? They're not driven by the environment, then.
The change is random.
This is something
that people have a lot of trouble
with. That's right. That's a big problem.
The mutation is random. It's what natural selection does to it that is not random. Natural selection is the director. Natural selection weeds out the ones that work and continues to allow the ones that do work to reproduce.
Okay, so the mutations could be just random mutations, just errors. And if those errors turn out to be beneficial to the organism, then they are adopted and used and makes the organism more able to survive.
Yes, and this randomness is part of the reason why so many people don't like the whole theory of evolution. You know, science has a way of humbling us. I said this in the first show. In the last 500 years, we've been dethroned. We used to think the Earth was the center of the universe. Copernicus and Galileo showed us that it wasn't, and that deflated our ego. Then Darwin comes along and says that we're not specially created. We're just a leaf on the tree of life. Then Freud comes along and shows us we don't even often know why we do things the way we do them. And what drives us to act in certain ways. And even today, as I mentioned earlier, we learn when we do the Human Genome Project, my God, we don't have as many genes as we thought. We're so complicated, but corn has more genes than we do.
And a lot of the genes are common genes in the critters.
That's right. But nevertheless, when I went to college a long time ago, we were still taught that we were special in other ways. We were taught that we use tools. Well, guess what? We can find animals that use tools. Then we were told, well, we have language. Well, we know that there are organisms that can talk to each other. They have language. Culture, meaning we learn something, we pass it on. Well, there are organisms that have culture. Oh, well, we say, well, we're self-aware, we're empathetic, we're altruistic. You can find all of these traits out there in nature. We may have some of them to a greater degree than other organisms, but we're not that special, and that's what hurts us. We want to think that we're special.
Right. And if you look at the so-called tree of life, or a modern equivalent of it called cladograms, which are drawing showing relationship of different species to each other, you can see that there are dead ends on the tree, okay? And what we think, and which is very difficult to accept, is that we are the result of some random mutation that occurred many years ago, and our branch of the tree seems to be doing pretty well, where there are other branches of the tree that came to dead ends, and those animals evolved, but they weren't successful. They had trouble with their environment. For example, when Saul said 98 or 99% of critters at one time on the earth were wiped out, well, it could have been the environment itself that caused it. There could have been a huge impact on the earth that threw up a lot of junk in the air and cut off the sun for years. And
which we think is out. why the dinosaurs lost out.
Right. The dinosaurs probably lost out because their environment changed and they couldn't adapt to it. Okay. They were very big and they had little brains. So maybe that had something to do with it. So that's the way I get back at tall people, because they're very tall. I say, well, you know, you're closer to the sun and you're going to have more radiation and your brain's going to be smaller. But that's only kidding around. So there are other examples that we could use also about that. So did you want to add something to that? I see you.
Well, I have a quote here talking about how we're so egocentric and we have difficulty with Darwin's theory. Darwin himself tried to address that, and what he wrote is, "Man, in his great arrogance, thinks him a great work, worthy the interposition of a deity. More humble, and I think truer to consider him, created from animals. It is our arrogance. It is our admiration of ourselves."
Okay, and there's where religion comes in also, and cultural comes into effect to it. So we're not going to go into that too much, but just a little bit about how early in history, Saul said, the astronomers thought that the Earth was at the center of the universe. And so it was an Earth-centered outlook. And then people like Galileo looked at the heavens and saw that the Earth was not at the center of the universe, that the sun was the center. And we're not even talking about the universe. We're talking about our own little solar system, which is one small galaxy in this huge, huge vastness of space. And the more that we perfect our instruments, and the more that we see, the more we see that we are a small galaxy and a small part of the universe. Just to give you a little example of that is Milky Way galaxy. We're called the Milky Way galaxy because if you look in the night sky on a clear night and you're not in the city, it looks like a band of white going across the sky, all the other stars and planets. So we are in our local group of galaxies, and so our Milky Way galaxy is one of the local group. There are two or three others with us, and we make up about 1% of the universe. So you can imagine how big the universe is, and the question coming up is there life on in other galaxies, on other planets? Well, we don't know yet, but someday we'll find out.
There is.
Okay, Saul says he thinks that there is life. The question is, what will that life be like? That's the other question. We you know, with our arrogance, as you said, or just whatever, think that if there is life, it should be like us, because that's how we were created in God's image. So the life should be us, based on carbon-based life that we need for to make ourselves and everything, But who knows? Maybe the life somewhere else in the universe will be completely different.
Maybe it'll be silicon-based.
Yeah, we have no idea.
We'll have sand people.
Right, the sand people. That would make a great movie.
Yeah.
The sand people. So, but what we are doing is that we are finding planets outside of our solar system called extrasolar planets, and we found about 300 of them, but they're so far away that we don't know much about them. And the only way that we can detect them is when these planets are revolving around the sun like we do. When they go in, when they pass in front of the sun, we can see a dimming of the light, and so we know that the planet is something is rotating around another star, because our sun is a star.
Yeah, we're looking for Goldilocks planets, the ones that are just right.
Just right. That's right. What was it in Goldilocks? Not too big.
Not too hot. Not too cold.
Right.
And that's what we've been looking for in the last few years. Up to that time, many of these extrasolar planets were huge gas giants, because the way you could detect them was they caused the sun that they were spinning around to wobble.
Right.
But now, as you just said, Bernie, astronomers are able to look at the diminution of light as the planet moves across the sun, because they have very sensitive telescopes. And so now we can look for smaller planets that are more like ours, a little farther away from the sun, in that Goldilocks window. That's not too hot, not too cold,
but
just right for life.
Right. Okay, so that's good. And I think we covered the topic, considering we only had two shows, and that really is not even 2 hours. It's, you know, our shows last a half hour, and with the breaks, it's only 9 minutes segment. So I think we covered it pretty well. Saul, did you want to say anything else before we conclude?
No, I think I've said it all right now.
Okay. I just wanted to bring up another example or two. Like critters that live in caves and critters that live way down in the deep oceans where it's always dark, they have lost their pigment too. Most of them look almost transparent or white colors, because if you're in perpetual darkness, you don't need camouflage to protect yourself, because it's always dark down there. So it doesn't make a difference what color you are. There's another example of an adaptation for living in an environment.
But I have to say that we fall into that trap when we talk about it, and I do the same thing.
Right.
I say they lost their pigment because they don't need it. But that's not the way it works.
Right, you're right.
It's easy to say it that way, but what's really happening is a mutation. Remember, a mutation has to occur to lose that pigment. And if it occurs, the pigment will be lost. And if that is beneficial, okay, fine. Why would it be beneficial in the cave? Well, then the organism doesn't have to use energy to make that pigment.
It's all about energy. They can use that energy to develop something else. Like Saul said, a more powerful jaws, better sense of smell. And I think we have about a minute or two left, so I'll mention one other critter that when I took my trip to Antarctica, and we learned about this fish called the ice fish. Well, you know that most fishes have blood in them, similar to ours, hemoglobin-based blood, which carries oxygen to the different parts of of our body. The blood supply supplies oxygen and nutrients. But this ice fish doesn't have any hemoglobin in its blood, because it has it is filling a niche in an environment that previously there weren't any fish like this. It lives in Antarctica, and the water cold, the temperature of the water is always close to zero, so it's a very, very cold environment. And in this environment of Antarctica, remember now that it's like Antarctica is like the Arctic. You have 6 months of daylight and 6 months of darkness. So the 6 months of daylight drives a whole system of plankton. So there's a huge, huge, huge food supply in these waters. And some of these plankton are phytoplankton, which are plant plankton, which produce oxygen. So in this freezing cold water, there's a huge amount of oxygen in the water. And normally, the oxygen level in the water is not very big. It's enough for 10 parts. If it gets below 10 parts per million, then fishes have trouble. But in Antarctica and probably in the Arctic, the oxygen supply is huge, because the colder the water is, the more oxygen it can hold. And remember, if you have this huge, huge supply of phytoplankton, they produce a lot of oxygen. So this fish has been able to live successfully because A, it doesn't need hemoglobin in its blood supply, so why waste your energy making it? So that's an adaptation. And the other thing is that it can make an antifreeze, like the same kind of antifreeze we used to put in our cars, ethylene glycol, which is an antifreeze. It's an alcohol made from sugars.
Which is normally toxic to life.
That's right. But these fish are able to survive with it. So that's another example of adaptations. And as Saul said, they are random mutations and adaptations. And if they're beneficial to the organism, then the organism will keep it. If it's not beneficial, they'll discard it, or the creature will not be able to adapt to its environment. And
success in evolution is making more babies. More babies than you, then I've been successful. If my adaptations allow me to survive longer to make those babies, I'm successful.
Right. So it's all about reproduction. It gets down to sex all the time.
It always gets down to sex.
So in some future programs, we're going to talk about animal reproduction techniques and strategies. And if you listened to some of my earlier programs, we spoke about bats and their reproductive strategies, which I think were very interesting. And my first show that I did, I spoke about the barnacles. And all of these shows are archived. So if you missed some of my show, you can go to Heritage Radio Network archives and you can listen to them. And by the way, you can listen to them anytime. We did two live shows today, but they're all put into the archives, and you can retrieve them anytime you want to. And also, you can even download them onto your iPod. So I hear the music coming up now, and that means we're going to have to stop. And remember, the music we played today was Stravinsky's The Rites of Spring, which deals with primitive rights, so-called primitive people's rights, and celebrating springtime and reproduction and all that good stuff. So we're going to sign off now, Heritage Radio Network. This is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist. And my guest today was Saul Scheinbach. And I think we did a pretty good covering evolution in our short time that we had.